I want to welcome everyone to our Keeping on Track open line. Lighthouse is celebrating 20 years in business, and we're just entering our seventh year of doing open lines. We have a few exciting changes that have taken place. You can now find an archive of past topics on our homepage under the Publication and Event tab, plus our new book, Cracking the Business Code, is available on Amazon, or you can click on the book icon on our homepage. Our topic today is what it takes to be an employer of choice domestically and globally. My name is Dana Barocca, and this topic is a very hot topic for everybody. If friends that you know are in business, roundtable group members aren't attending today and they have to be in your Vistage group or some other CEO roundtable group, you'll want to share this audio and slides when we get done today. We'll get everybody a copy of that because this is the number one issue for attracting talent, the talent war out there. I'm the CEO of Lighthouse Consulting Services for those of you joining us for the first time, and I'll be hosting our program today. We have a few housekeeping items, and we're going to jump right into our topic. For those of you joining us for the first time at Lighthouse, everything we do goes back to our mission statement, bringing effective insights to your organization. And we do this through our in-depth work style and personality assessments to help raise the hiring bar. Our Keeping on Track open line series is in response to many calls we get for offering different topics from our clients both domestically and globally to address business issues that organizations are facing today. Our goal is to make this an interactive program, so on your screen you'll see an area you can send questions or ideas in during the discussion. We'll attempt to respond to as many as possible, so please join us with your thoughts and insights you have along the way. At the conclusion of our program, we're going to open up the line so you can talk directly with our guests. So during our program, please write down two or three questions to either send in during the program or you can ask once we open the line up. Our panel today is made up of not only thought leaders for this topic, but each is a close friend of mine out of Lighthouse and are all very cool individuals. And I'm just so excited and grateful to have each person a part of this program because it is such a hot topic. And each individual truly is a thought leader on this topic. So let's start. I'm going to introduce our panel members. These are in alphabetical order. Larry Cassidy has been a Vistage chair for the past 25 years. He currently works with some 50 executives every month and has facilitated over 1,200 executive group meetings and participated in 11,000 face-to-face discussions with chief executives about all aspects of their businesses. He prepared for his journey at Miami University in Ohio and Northwestern for his MBA. He was also a Marine Corps officer. So, Larry, you can't take charge today. You're out of the Corps. He's also worked with public companies such as General Mills, Quaker Oats, and PepsiCo. He has also served and worked with private, family-owned businesses, foreign-owned organizations, and in the 1980s as a general manager and CEO of local companies in the Southern California area. Next is Mark Emmer. Mark is a consultant, author, and speaker sought after by CEOs throughout North America as an expert on strategic planning and performance improvement. Mark's firm, Optimizing Inc., has an impressive list of clients, including CB Richard Ellis, Rio Tinto, Superior Industries, and dozens of small and mid-market companies. The release of Mark's book, Intended Consequences, was covered online by Forbes, CNBC, Fox, and CBS, and his weekly blog is syndicated by Vistage International. Mark has also served on several for-profit and nonprofit boards. Next, we have Steve Phillips, PhD. Steve has a unique method for preparing teams for the future and specializes in offsites for senior leadership. Some of his clients include Microsoft, PepsiCo, Viacom, Mattel, and Boeing, as well as many smaller companies looking to develop their senior leadership and grow them. He is the author of many books, including the Team Building Sourcebook, Team Building for the Future, Beyond Basics, and Team Training from Startup to High Performance, just to name a few. Steve has also served on the faculty of Purdue University, San Diego State University, Pepperdine, and University of Southern California. But, Steve, we won't bring up the Bruins today, if that's okay.
Thank you, Dana.
Paul David Walker is a CEO coach who has worked with numerous Fortune 500 CEOs and their key staff members for well over 25 years, along with many mid-cap companies. Some of the organizations that Paul has worked with include Starkist Foods, Vons Grocery Stores, New York Life, Anne Klein, Rockwell International, countless manufacturing companies, global utilities, service, and consulting organizations. Paul is the founder of Genius Dome Partners and works with domestic and international companies to improve their bottom line today and for planning for the future. Paul is the author of many books. One of them is a best-selling book called Unleashing Genius, and his new book just came out, Invent Your Future, Starting with Your Calling. It's an outstanding book. If you haven't read it, get it. I feel so privileged to have our panel members with us today and to share ideas that will help each of us in preparing for the future and for dealing with today's business issues. Also, at the end of our program, registration will be offered for our next program, which will be offered in July. So I want to welcome to our guests. We're doing a little different process today since we do have a panel. So let me explain our format. I'm going to toss out a question. We will have the question up on the screen, and then members of the panel can share 1 or 2 minutes of their thoughts, and then to address the topic, and then at the end we'll do a recap where everybody can kind of cover things that came to mind during the program. Again, we want to invite our guests to throw in various questions. We may answer them in the moment, or we may hold them till the end. And at the end of the program, we're going to open up the line so you can talk directly with our panel guests. So, without further ado, let's begin. So, our first question is, as the economy has generally improved, employees now have an increasing range of choices both for employment both domestically and globally. Finding top talent is getting more difficult. How should companies position themselves to be an employer of choice? Who would like to share?
I'll jump in, Dana. This is Mark.
Okay.
My perspective is, you know, we've recently seen some pretty controversial articles in HBR and elsewhere on companies like Netflix and Deloitte. And the common thread in these articles, many of which have gone viral, is that is the dismantling of some pretty commonly accepted human capital best practices, not the least of which is kind of the traditional annual performance review process. And I think it reflects a broader issue, which is that many of the human capital best practices that we've employed are just kind of broken. And honestly, I see a pretty big delta between employers of choice and many of the entrepreneurial and mid-market companies that we work with. And all you have to do is look at the results of these practices to see why they're being challenged. In a lot of companies, you know, positions are remaining open for many months. Turnover is still high, especially in the first year of employment. There's very little onboarding or training for new employees. A lot of managers don't take performance reviews seriously. Incentive plans are either poorly constructed or they don't have enough teeth to motivate people. So I think the net result of all this is most of the employers I work with, they would classify maybe a quarter of their employees as A players or even less. So we need to look beyond the tight labor market and kind of look in the mirror and start to examine, you know, some of the practices we've employed, especially as they relate to millennials who obviously have a completely different view of the world and of their employers.
Hey, I'd like to jump in next. I'm Steve, and I have two examples I'd like to bring to bear on this. One is a very personal example. I guess they both are. I've done a great deal of work at JPL where we actually tried to revamp JPL as an employer of choice for the millennials, because the kids coming out of school in the STEM programs would now have other choices. So truly understanding the millennials, giving them what they want in terms of quick promotions, lots of attention, lots of responsibility right away, Lots of information. When they first come on to campus there, they should have a loaded iPad handed to them. Those are the types of things they want. They want mentors, and they want to be paid attention to, given responsibility, and hopefully will thrive quickly. The second example is my son just graduated from Stanford literally 2 days ago with a fantastic job in Palo Alto. The package that he got, he was given offers by all of the big software design companies, Google and Microsoft and so on and so forth, and he took a job at Palantir, which is an up-and-coming, very powerful company. And the package that he got was unheard of. The unlimited vacations, the amount of money, the amount of stock options, the ability to design his own job, the fact that he could rate his own boss, the concierge services, the reimbursements for rent so that he could live in a very expensive neighborhood. I think what they're really doing to make themselves an employer of choice is doing super cool work, going after the millennial very specifically in what they want, and then giving them what they believe they need all the way around.
So to me, that kind of ties into my thought. I think people are looking for a sense of belonging, a sense of being part of something, and not only when they get in the company, but companies that provide that sense of belonging. It tends to inspire people. Some of the things you mentioned, Steve, certainly, you know, give them that, and a sense of freedom to create towards a goal, towards something that is important or greater than themselves. I think that's really core, both to maintaining performance inside of a company, but also to attracting them.
This is Larry. I think that is really good stuff. For the people that are listening, I have a suggestion, and the suggestion is that you do something different. And what I mean by that is, put it in terms, if I was going back to run a company, I would realize that I tend to talk to a lot of people during the day who are like me and think like me, and I would take time to talk to the kinds of people that I need to and want to hire about what is important to them. I'm not going to find out what's important to them by talking to fellow 50 and 60-year-olds. I need to get down in the trenches, sit down, chat, and ask some genuinely good questions to find out what it is that young and middle-aged, high-performing people want. And my second comment, one of you guys talked about 20-25% of their company is A players. Any company that's got 25% of their A players is doing pretty good, since there's probably only about 10% of them in society. And I think if you're going to be a company that keeps people once you get them, you're going to have systems and processes that help them get better and better. If I come to your company and I'm essentially a B-plus player, I want a few years later to be and to feel like I'm an A-minus or A player because I have really improved while I work there. And I think everybody who goes to work wants that feeling when they drive home.
Those are good.
Yeah.
That's
great.
Great insights. A question came in. I'd like to address it quickly, then we'll go to the next slide. How do you equate the millennials' needs to running a business?
I don't know. This is Steve. I'm not sure I can exactly answer that question. The traditional structure in businesses, the way we've designed jobs, is not what's going to work for the millennials. They're the gaming society. They need instant gratification. They want small chunks of work and full responsibility. And then they also want somebody to ask for help. They're so used to Googling an answer that they can just get an answer. And when the answers aren't available because it's company specific, they need to turn to somebody to get that help. I've actually helped a number of companies now redesign jobs into job packets. But if you continue to get stuck on the traditional organizational structure, then it doesn't really work for millennials, and you have a hard time keeping them because they will jump very quickly.
Yeah, it's not even working for the military.
Well, the statistics that I hear, and everybody's got statistics, is that a lot of the millennials are saying that they make up their mind on whether they want to stay sometime in the first 24 to 48 hours they're in a company. Mm-hmm. So Steve's comment about a loaded iPad and really welcoming him and greeting him and making him feel important from the start. Well, you know, guys, we can like that or not like it. It may or may not be like what happened when we went to work. Forget it. If you want these people, you're going to have to play in that trench.
And that's going to come into many of our other questions down the road. I don't want to take up too much time, but the social workplace has become incredibly important. And, Dan, I'll back off that until we get there. But I have one son graduate 2 days ago. I have three that have entered the workforce in the last 2 years. And I've watched what they tried to do to get jobs and the companies they chose and what those practices were of those companies that made my kids want to say, yeah, I want to go work for them.
Steve, let's make sure we address that. That'll be very cool. What cultures either attract or detract in the marketplace?
Well, hierarchical cultures detract. Cultures that are bureaucratic and rigid detract. And the ones that attract are the ones that are, you know, on a mission that you feel like you're part of something greater than yourself, that you feel like you belong, that you feel like something important is happening, and you feel like you're an important part of the game. And I think something that Steve mentioned earlier, people need to know what a friend of mine's daughter was employed by Google, and the first day on the job, they got together with her team, and her team's, the first thing they said to her is, okay, what are you going to contribute? And it's that empowerment. That, and it just rings out. You know, everybody wants to work for Google, right? They have a reputation that is important in the marketplace. And I think building your brand in the marketplace that fits with not just all millennials, because some millennials are just slugs, but the real powerful, ambitious millennials who want to do something with their life. So I think it's careful. You have to be careful not to, you know, dumb down the company to, you know, fit every millennium, but you want to model your culture around, you know, the high performers.
Mark, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think there's a big difference in how leaders need to show up versus before the Great Recession. I think there's a level of fear that didn't exist before. So what employees really want to see is they want to see companies that are led with vision. And mm-hmm. you can see a commitment to human capital in a corporate vision. And, you know, you see it on the recruiting page. You see it in the lobby. You see it in how people talk to recruits, how they talk to their employees. So I just think we need to be extremely cognizant of how we face with employees and recruits and how we convey our ideal future to them.
And Steve, you had mentioned about your kids being in the marketplace. So what attracted them to the organizations?
You know, Dan, there was a lot of things. Let me comment on the culture, and then I'm happy to say that. I'm finding we have four full-blown cultures in organizations today. So although we can design for the millennials, we can't forget the traditionalists and the Generation X and so forth. And I think that what that bodes to is much more agility in companies, where if we're standing for something, if the leadership vision is there, as was mentioned, is if we're working for a greater cause, if that's what's going on, we tend to have really solid values. But those values can be interpreted in different ways at different levels. So I'm thinking much more inclusive today than ever, and different structures in different parts of the organization to serve different needs. And not to be so hung up on that everything's uniform and organized, but that the whole system with many subsystems that might seem chaotic actually works together. And I'll tell you, Dana, what attracted my kids to the jobs, honestly, Parker said something that was mind-blowing to me. When he took the job at Palantir, he goes, Dad, I think I found my people. And he said the same thing to me when he got accepted, his second year at Stanford. He goes, Dad, I finally found my people. There's something very social about the workplace today. The way the kids do their work and the way they connect to people and the way they do it all at the same time. That seems to be very attractive. Smart people with resources where a company cares about you, where you have freedom to do your work, fully responsible for it, and you can be very social at the same time. And then to add the icing on the cake, and Paul said it earlier, and we're working for a cause. We're working for something we can all believe in.
Yeah, both my son and daughter-in-law said the same things. My son runs one of the top restaurants in L.A., and my daughter-in-law works for Chanel on Rodeo Drive. And she left several other high-end boutiques because she couldn't find her people, and now she's found them. And same thing. And they'll do whatever it takes to succeed once they get in that environment that they love.
Huh. Interesting.
So it's not an identification to job or company. It's an identification to the social side of their work.
Yeah.
Huh. That's really important insight. Larry, any thoughts on this topic?
Well, I think that's just really great stuff. The only thing I would add is, you know, we really had a precursor of this starting several years ago. If you look at on the last decade, you have high school kids. Think about the dating scene back then. It wasn't just a couple running off. It was, my son was that age. They were hanging out in groups.
Yep.
They were hanging out in groups. They weren't going off by themselves to the movie. And, yeah, they had, that's my girlfriend, that's my boyfriend, but they were running around in packs. They wanted to be together. I'm not a social psychologist, so I don't know what drove that. But, boy, and I heard all kinds of parents talking to me about it. It's like, amazing. How different. Well, look where we are now in the workplace. Look what they want to do now. You can kind of connect the dots, I think.
This is a great segue into the next slide. Next slide's not coming up, so I'll read it off.
Okay.
So much for technology. What should companies do differently in order to attract younger workers than what they have done in the past?
You know, Dana, for me, the first thing is, I think as boomers, we kind of need to get over ourselves. just because we have a way of working, that doesn't mean that they're going to work the same way. And I think that's actually a cause, a lot of the angst. I think a lot of boomers think that millennials are lazy and kind of disenchanted. And I, like Steve and the others on the call, I work with millennials, I parent millennials, and I don't think they're lazy at all. I just think they have a different way of working, much like Steve was describing with JPL and delivering the iPad on the first day of employment with all the content that they want. But they clearly want to connect with companies. They want to understand the social aspects of how companies work. And so I just think we need to embrace that instead of fighting it.
And, you know, another thing that I've discovered is that while all that is true, right, and people have things that block them from succeeding, you know, we all have different things in our life depending on what generation we came from. But what I find with a lot of the millennials is what blocks them from succeeding, what blocks their motivation, is when they're not getting rewarded, when they're not getting acknowledged. They're almost on some level addicted to praise and acknowledgement. And there's good news there and there's bad news there. And I think us boomers, who our idea of acknowledgement is getting a big paycheck, that's not their idea of acknowledgement. And their idea of acknowledgement is much more granular, much more social, and much more personal. And the leaders of companies, which tend to be boomers, are going to have to get used to that.
Yeah, this is Steve. I'd like to jump in. Good point, you guys. I'm loving this conversation. I don't want to take it too far away, at least in my own thinking, from job design, because I also worked with Mattel around this one, where, because, like Paul said, the millennials need that sort of praise, they want to make progress. Earlier we talked about them developing and getting better and better. The way jobs are designed now, it's very difficult for them to step up in small pieces. Most of the jobs they're doing when they first come into the workplace is a piece of a larger piece of work instead of a whole small piece. Like in the when you play video games or online gaming, it's small things. You get rewarded quickly. You get up to the next level quickly, and it keeps people connected to the game. I think if we really want to design for millennials, then we need to look at the way the jobs are designed, because many of them were designed 50 years ago, and the new job designs aren't at all like the old job designs, and the millennials like it much, much better. Like I said earlier, some of the older folks in the workplace, they don't like it. So I think we have to have combinations of job designs for folks to really stay happy.
And I think that's been true for 30 years. If people can see they're making progress and growing, and if you can challenge them all the time, they love it. I just think the millennials can't operate any other way. You know, but it's a good way to run a company, good way to see constant feedback, constant growth, constant moving towards something important.
I think my thoughts, Dana, have a couple of them, to piggyback on one thing that I think was said earlier. We need to get over thinking that millennials aren't hard workers and this and that and the other thing. If you think that, it shows up in how you come across. And if I'm a millennial, I'll pick up on that, and I won't want anything to do with you. Secondly, the more I listen to this conversation, the more I think about it, there are things we need to do that are unique and special for millennials. But there's a whole heck of a lot of stuff that's been mentioned that any good performer of any age
Yes.
wants to experience in any company. I want to be appreciated. I want to be involved. I want. It's just that the older age folks aren't, because of how we grew up, as open to speaking up about it. The millennial speaks up about it by going down the street to another job. Oh, by the way, they may pay less down there, but it's more fun. Those are my people. And the third thing, just as a practical suggestion, is our organizations have been flattened by what's happened to the economy. So I went to work, and I wanted to climb the ladder and get to the top. And I did. And it wasn't everything it was cracked up to be. And that's not available in a lot of companies now. So if you want to really intrigue the millennial or any sharp young person, turn that ladder on its side and give them a number of different experiences. I've talked to young people who love I worked in finance for a year and a half, and then they let me work in R&D. Next month I'm going on the road, and I'm going to learn how to sell. They like that experiential thing. And so just turn the ladder on its side, which you can do.
Hey,
yeah,
I'm a boomer.
Dana, I went on the Glassdoor last night and looked up all my clients, which is kind of an interesting exercise. And, of course, Glassdoor it skews towards the negative, right? So, you know, we have to take it with a grain of salt. But what's interesting about what you read there is what the millennials complain about when they're dissatisfied is that there's no room for advancement. So I think the conversation needs to be about, you know, how can they acquire more skills as opposed to aspire to rise to this particular position, which has been our lens in the past.
Yeah. Yep.
Good point.
Yeah, I'm a boomer, and I don't want to work with anybody I don't like, and I won't.
Exactly.
Somebody's a CEO is a jackass. I thank you, but I'm busy. So, you know.
Let's go to the next topic. Where does compensation, flex hours, mobility, a collaborative environment, appreciation, recognition, and respect play into this topic? And you've covered some of these things. But any thoughts on the mobility issue or flex hours?
Well, Dana, you know I've already needled you that the question is the answer. I mean, all those things play into it. I think one of the comments I want to make on this one is, particularly around flex hours and people working away from the office, I have very traditional companies I work with, yet they're doing more and more of that little by little. And it is forcing them to learn how to evaluate employees based on results. as
right.
opposed to are they at work on time and did they dress nicely today, you know, yada, yada, yada. And that's something we're not the best at, as Mark referred to early on in his comments. We need to learn how to address real performance and then reward real performers. You do those two things and do them well, you've got a fighting chance.
Yeah, one of the key things I say in all of my books is you cannot create what you cannot conceive. And if the people working for you can't conceive what you want them to create, then, you know, you're dead in the water. And business today, and it always has been like a team sport. It's a collaborative process. If you do not access the wisdom, knowledge of the people in the company, then, you know, it's the post office. And so this whole business of having a clear, compelling picture for each person in terms of what they create, what you want them to create, and how that fits into the big picture, how that makes everybody, you know, the whole social group, the whole company better. Your part's important because it helps all of us. To me, that's collaboration.
Yeah, I might add something here as well. I think this is the answer, as funny that it's phrased as a question. But as I look at this and I watch what Parker just went through to take his job, it's just so fresh for me that there were so many good examples. He got in his package, I had never heard of this, maybe I'm behind the times, but when he first told me, he has unlimited vacation. Unlimited vacation,
yeah.
Unlimited time off, unlimited. And I said, you know, Parker, that probably means you're selling your soul and that this, you're going to be so busy that you won't have any time to take off at all. And he goes, no, Dad, I actually asked everybody about that. And what they said is, I just need to get somebody on my team to cover for me, just like I'll cover for the people when they want to go off. And really, Dad, we're just trying to get something done. And I thought that was really sort of enlightening for a company that I'm sure is all young, hot, smart kids, that they just know they're trying to get something done. They're going to do whatever it takes to get there. They're going to work from wherever they need to work to make it happen. They're going to be committed to each other along that process. And they have structure and strategy built in to support it. Very different than what I'm used to hearing.
Yeah, that really resonates with me. I think this is about frame of mind, and we just need to recognize our employees as individuals. I've been running a virtual company for the last 13 years. We have no work schedule, and I think our team is very, very productive, and that's because, you know, I can go to my assistant and say, hey, we need to leave at 5 a.m. in the morning for a retreat, and she's happy to do it because, you know, the following day, if she wants to go to her son's Taekwondo practice at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I could care less. So, you know, it's a win-win, and that's what we need to understand, not only the value that we're creating for the employer, we need to equally understand the value we're creating for the employee.
And this takes great leadership skills. I mean, you have to be able to paint that picture of what those results are, and it's not – the results generally are not the bottom line. I mean, the results you're looking for is what feeds the top line, what brand you're creating. And you've got to really paint a clear picture of that. Otherwise, it just becomes chaos. And that's a challenge for leaders.
So, but that's only because they're oriented that they're afraid of numbers. I think it was Steve who mentioned earlier, or no, it was Larry who mentioned earlier, that this is guiding us towards different style of performance management, and I just think it's very uncomfortable for a lot of managers.
Yeah.
So what we talked about, ideas that have come up, cross-training, which is a great thing, the team working together to be excited about someone going on vacation and covering, so that goes back to the team and the collaborative environment. What I'm hearing from some companies is when it comes to sales departments, some organizations say, no, you have to have a sales group in brick and mortar to keep the energy going and blah, blah, blah. I've heard other companies say, if you have great salespeople, what does it matter where they are? They're going to perform. What are your guys' thoughts on that for sales departments? Should they be in a brick and mortar thing because of the energy? Or
Well, unless I'm doing telemarketing, why do I want my salespeople in my office? I want my salespeople out with my customers. You know, the studies that are done now that I'm privy to, and I get to hear some sales and sales management speakers, is that in an eight-hour day, the average salesperson is spending somewhere between an hour and a half in front of customers. I mean, think about that. That's, like, not enough.
No.
I want my folks out selling. Now, if I'm doing telemarketing, obviously I'd like them doing telemarketing and during business hours where they can reach people. But no, I'm not interested in paying for office space and desks and all that stuff for people to sit around. We're supposed to be selling.
Okay. Any other thoughts on that topic?
Well, Dan, I have another thought. I think it was a question that came in, and I was going to give this example anyway. It was, you know, how do you transition a typical company into the type of company that we're talking about? And I've been fortunate in the last 2 years to end up doing a fair amount of culture work. It's not something I hang my shingle out on, but I'm being asked to help cultures evolve, to assess them. Traditional cultures that want to become more of an employer of choice, traditional cultures that are looking for new ways to do things, to build their capacity, reduce their costs. And I got to tell you, it's a pretty difficult shift because it really does start with the senior team being okay, and they're often not okay. They'll say they're okay, but they're really not. But when you talk to the workers that come to work every day, that sit at their desks, that do their job, they really do want to have freedom over their own time. They really feel like they should be able to come and go as they please, as long as they're getting their work done. And the transition to start doing, you know, maybe casual Fridays was a long time ago, and then maybe, you know, 4-10s in terms of working and you get an extra day off, or maybe people being able to come in on their own once or twice a week whenever they feel their schedule will be important or that they could be out of the office. I think small steps start to prove that nothing goes wrong when you take these new actions. And I don't know that you can actually just take an old traditional company and make it into one of these newfangled, you know, millennial hot companies. But I do think there are practices that you can bring on one at a time that workers will really appreciate, really like, won't take advantage of you. And then you start to build this deeper connection between them and the company. And they talk about that, and that attracts people.
Hmm. Any other thoughts on that?
Well, the studies that I'm familiar with, and I certainly not all of them, are now suggesting that people who work away from the office, virtual workers, inappropriate roles, are actually tend to outperform those who are in the office, which, of course, is hard for we old-timers to swallow. The other thing, I'm sure there's some people out there listening, and maybe some of us have had this experience. If you have a young person working for you, you wake up the next morning, and there's three emails from them, and they were sent at 11:45, 2 a.m., and 3:30 a.m. They work when they work. That's why we've got to be willing and able to evaluate results. They don't work necessarily, you know, 8 to 5. They work when they get excited, and then they work. And if they're good, I want that work.
And you know, in terms of culture change, you know, I've been doing it for about 30 years now, and it emanates, like Steve said, from the leadership. It emanates from this, not just what they say. Matter of fact, what they say is kind of irrelevant. What they do. Culture is, the simple definition of culture is the way we do things around here.
Right.
And that's it. And so you got to look at the way we do things around here, and is that going to work? And you can't direct a collaborative environment if there's not a compelling picture of the outcomes you're looking for and a feeling of deep belonging to the team and the mission. You just can't do it. And a lot of old leaders are, you know, they just want to come in and be the CEO or the senior vice president, you know, saunter around and look important. And that ain't going to cut it.
I'm going to simplify it further and say if you want to be an employer of choice, you have to provide choice.
Yeah, there you go.
Ooh, that is nice. Really well done, Mark. And, you know, it's interesting. Larry brought up something about studies. Many, many years ago, Pac Bell, when telecommuting was just coming out, they did a study, I believe it was through USC, and they found, it was a very heavy-duty study, they found that having the right person telecommute, they would be between 30 to 300% more efficient if they're set up properly and it's the right person. So
we
can increase the opportunity by catering to those that are even more adept at being mobile today. So let's go to our next slide. Setting up the social work environment, the virtual coffee bar. Let's talk about some examples of how that works. One of our clients, and has been Mark's client also, they went virtual. They took 70 to 100 people. They restructured their entire organization. They had cheers for doing so. Some people were a little resistant, but most people were very happy, and now they all love it. So how do you work the social environment for them when people aren't together?
Well, it's interesting. We worked with, of all companies, British Gas in the 90s, and the CEO decided to create a social environment, to create an office that just had round tables, no conference rooms, no walls. He sat out with everybody, and of course, you know, the British were like having fits and, oh, God. But one of the things he found was a result of that is there was a lot less gossiping, a lot less finger-pointing, because everybody could hear you, right? So there was no quiet place where you could go and talk badly about the other person on the team. And it actually, they found it really improved their productivity, particularly at the executive level and at every level. Of course, the people out in the field are digging holes and putting pipes in, but in terms of the leadership, they had a great experience. So
this is Steve again, and I actually have quite a bit to say on this. I'm going to keep it brief. I'll circle back around after everybody gets a chance. Many of my clients now are setting up highly social work environments. There's even buildings now that are set up for highly social work environments in a bunch of small companies. There's one in Santa Monica called ROC, R-O-C, and it's just a three-story building, but it must have 300 companies in it, all of them in glass cubicles. Massive open social space. And you don't even have to rent a cubicle. You can just rent your entrance into the building, which puts you in all the different social spaces and coffee bars. The reason they're doing that is not just because we want it to be social. We want cross-pollination. There's another one of these buildings, Media Temple's in it over on National Boulevard in Culver City. Several of my clients did the traditional thing for the non-traditional workplace, setting up ping pong tables and video games and things like that. And, you know, in most places, they're very used. And everybody just goes there, hangs out, gets their coffee, plays their games. Once again, if the leadership thinks people are wasting their time, then people will feel the fear in the workplace. But the millennials and others know that they're actually thinking about what they should be thinking about. They're cross-pollinating when they're in these social situations, and they love it. It actually builds great community. And so there's something really powerful about this social community and working together that's attractive for people.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, which is enabling these physical spaces that you're describing or lack thereof, is the technology is emerging really quickly. You have these tools like Huddle and Basecamp and Rike. And, you know, we recently instituted a new workflow process on the cloud, and it was pretty game-changing for our firm and how we work. So I think if you're really interested in collaboration, you almost have to start with the technology and then build your physical space around it so that you know, your team can remain highly productive even if they're virtual.
And there's very little, and not in the virtual, but in these office buildings and these places that are built for social, very little paper. Very, very little. When I walk in with my pad and my pen, I'm a dinosaur.
Yeah.
No,
you
would.
Steve, what I noticed, Steve, is I'm not in your league or the league of the other two guys here in terms of social technology. I notice that I'm not an expert on it, but I noticed simple things like, do you remember a few years ago when we were all convinced that kids were going to grow up and not know how to deal with each other because they're always on their electronics? And then we all woke up a little while ago to realize that that's how they connect with each other. And they do it all the time. I have a guy in the car business. He says the car business may be in a bit of trouble in the United States. They don't need cars to connect anymore like we did when we were growing up. They connect all the time. So I think in addition to inside the office, we've got to run our businesses in a way that the ways that they connect with each other are allowed and useful to them to contribute to our business, whether they're in an office or not.
And I think the environment
encouraged.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think the environment is a real important part of that. Just a silly example. A friend of mine just got back from Africa, and she's African American, so she's going for her roots, and she lived with a tribe. And her impression was that even though they were dirt poor, living out in the pampas or jungle, whatever it is out there, the environment of nature around them was so empowering to them. They just had a sense of belonging and immersion in nature that, you know, that we don't get. And that's a statement about the environment, how it impacts us. And our environments tend to be still based on castles and walls. And
right.
It creates fear right there. Right? We don't really need castles and walls anymore, right? But we still structure our organizations like that. So the environment, I think, helps.
One more quick example. This is of my daughter. I knew we were going to be talking about this, so I studied my kids for our conversation. Jessica, my 23-year-old daughter who graduated from NYU, works as a social media publicist. So she's online all the time publicizing movies and companies, movies that haven't come out yet, and companies that are about to launch something. She gets the influencers online to post things, and then they pay them money, and then everybody knows about it for all the millions and millions of people online. When I asked her about the virtual workplace, because if she's a social media publicist, she could be anywhere, I said, what do you think about coming into work, Jessica? She said, I love coming into work, Daddy. All my friends are there. We all work together. When something's about to get released, we're all working on it together, and you can hear us cheer when stuff happens. And so once again, it comes back to this new way of, yeah, I don't have to be in the workplace. I like being in the workplace. I like being with my friends. I like accomplishing things and sharing that accomplishment with a bunch of people. And I've been to her workplace. It's in New York. And her office layout, I mean, there's like 10 of them in a bay. They're all working on the same thing at the same time. And when something online happens that's big, you can see them all head down, all on the computer, all typing like crazy. Something else happens, and then they all look up, and then they go, we did it. It's like crazy. Never seen anything like it. But it's not, they don't need to be virtual, even though they could be. They like being around their peers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It sounds like they're having fun.
Mm-hmm.
Steve, I have a question for you. So let's say a company decides, like Northrop did, they got the CFO was in their big building one day and said, half the people aren't there, what are we paying all this space for? So they made a big change. So they put in little hotel reservation locations around the country where people can take the space and go there and work, or they can do it from home.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say a company decides to go virtual, they're expanding that. What is a virtual coffee bar? How can people stay socially connected from what you've seen and studied?
You know what, Dana? It's crazy how connected they are between Facebook and what is it, the chat. There's another, and the one for pictures. I'm not good at all these names. I didn't write them all down. But they are connecting instantly with their community, however many that is, can be 100 people at once, through different social software programs. Snapchat is one. I'm trying to think of the other ones that are Instagram, where they post pictures.
Instagram.
Facebook, where they're talking to each other. It depends on what age they are and what they're using. We all use LinkedIn. They think we're dinosaurs at LinkedIn. You know, that's just not what they're using at all. But
yeah.
So the idea is they are staying connected. They're just staying connected on their devices.
Okay,
so they can
Steve.
They're literally, if you watch any of these 20-somethings work, they are all over their device, both
right.
while they're on their computer and while they're working on their phone. And they're literally having 4 or 5 conversations in any given moment.
Steve, you and the rest of us may remember this thing called Twitter.
Yeah,
you know that the millennials, that Twitter is not even in the top 20 favorites for millennials today. It's so yesterday.
What I think is really ironic about this conversation, just think about the themes that we've discussed so far. People want to work in small pods where they're highly interactive and highly collaborative. We need to measure for the results and pay attention to the numbers. These aren't new ideas. That stuff's straight out of lean manufacturing, the Toyota way that
yep.
was written 35 years ago. It's just that
yep.
we applied it in production back then, and we're just now figuring it out that we need to apply it in the workplace as well.
And we need to learn to put a smile on it.
Yeah,
and it,
that's right.
It violates a lot of the traditionalist ways of doing things. I will never, ever forget walking into my kids' bedroom when they were in the 7th or 8th grade. They're doing homework, and they've got the music on. They're IMing their friends. They're on their computer. They've got the TV going, and it looked crazy to me. And I just said, what are you doing? And they said, we're doing our homework, Dad. What do you think? I'm like, who's on your computer? My classmates are on the computer. You know, they were talking to each other working. My kids did well, so I never stopped them. But the processes that we're talking about violate some of the older people's sensibilities for what's focused and what's right. And we just have to release and let people work the way they work and do focus on their outcomes.
So, like,
and
Steve, if I was going to hire you, one of the things I'd want to see in you is not that you know everything, but you have the ability to go get information.
Mm-hmm.
Let's think about what these kids are doing. They go get information from everywhere. They are way better at that than we were when we came out. The trick for us is to harness it.
That's a good point. Listen, we don't have much time here because this is such a exciting conversation. And, Mark, you made a really good point there. It looks different. It really isn't. How can a company leverage career pathing for continuous development and growth? I know we talked about this earlier. Any other thoughts on this topic?
I'll jump in real quick. I've been helping many, many, many of my clients who've lost a lot of their workers put better career paths in place, but it's not really the career path that matters in my estimation. It's the fact that the high potential has somebody looking out after them and pushing them into learning something new and going to another place. The millennials, in my estimation, aren't all about making their careers happen. They're about learning and growing. And having somebody help them. They hate being frustrated when they can't find information quickly. So I think career paths are very, very important, but more important is the application of a mentor or a guide or a buddy that helps people continue to move around in an organization.
I had Dana and I had breakfast this morning with a former member, and he's in his mid-70s, and I'm in my late 70s, and we spent the better part of an hour and a half talking about a small handful of people in our lives when we were young who made a huge difference in our lives. So what we're now talking about is not just confined to millennials. Everybody needs exactly what was just said. You know, strong mentorship, strong coaching.
I live in Long Beach, so I work with the Long Beach Fire Department, Ed. And I'm trying to decide what I can do for them, you know, for a reasonable price that doesn't take up all my time. So I put together this leadership, coaching, and mentoring program, a little one-page blurb, and the chief sent it out. In 2 days, 15 people signed up.
Wow.
Just like that, right? We had to cut it off because people want to grow. And it's a very sort of paramilitary organization, but that didn't matter. They want to grow. The growth and having a mentor, but growing is its own reward. It always has been. And it's its own reward. When you learn something new, when you cross a threshold in your life, it's exciting. And when you don't, you start the process of dying, honestly.
I would urge everybody who's listening to this to take a moment to think about who was really influential in your life that helped you get to where you are today, and then think about who in my life could I do that for?
Yep.
One of the things that's happening online more and more now, because the kids did it in school, is something called Rate My Boss. They had it in school called Rate My Teacher. And and they don't want to just be rated themselves. They want to rate their boss. I took Uber the other day. The guy rated me, and I rated him. I think that's coming. And I think as we get more and more mentor/bosses, I think they'll get more and more popular. I think it's incredibly powerful for people to have somebody to help them and be concerned about their livelihood.
We're not going to do that with spouses, right?
No, it'd be better. It'd be fun.
Close call.
Let's go to our next slide. We only have a couple left, and we're coming to the top of the hour. How do all these things get packaged so they align with a corporate vision?
That's the trick.
I think that's right. It's either part of the corporate vision or it isn't.
Ooh.
You know, like an indicator for me is, you know, I work with a client, 3,200 employees. We have no vice president of human resources. It's like, do you consider human capital to be an important part of your strategy and your infrastructure, or is it, you know, a compliance-oriented function? I think there's a great deal of variability from company to company in how they think about that.
Yeah. I think I'm just going to go back to the compelling picture of the outcome you're looking for, and you organize around that on the big picture, on the small picture, and in a granular way. And if you're not doing that, you're going to be too slow to succeed. And I think leaders, I'm working with a company right now, they're siloed. It's a financial services company, and their rating on Glassdoor is horrible. They're thinking about changing the name of their company. And they've got to get over it. And, you know, I'm being very aggressive with them and telling them that they're dinosaurs, and if they don't snap out of it, they will lose their investment, which is a considerable amount of money. And they're getting it, right? But what it comes down to, once they get it, they go, okay, great, I'm going to be a sort of new company, you know, and all this. Then it's the know-how, right? It's one thing to get it and to see it works, but how do you develop the know-how throughout your company, particularly in your leadership? And that's where I think we can help a lot of companies get the know-how. Because it's, you know, why? Okay, we know why, right? We know what. You know, we want to have people inspired and developing results that lead to success. But how do we do that? To me, so many people, so many consulting firms give them everything but the how. You know, we followed McKinsey around doing the how. We would take their strategy, and once it got dusty on the shelf, say, well, how's it going? Well, you know, I don't know. So we always focused on the know-how, and I think that's really important because it's different.
The other thing, too, is I think presentation is important. I grew up as a marketing guy, but I don't think you can package anything you don't have. The first order of business is to have it. And everything in my book starts at the top if you really want to have it as part of your culture.
So I'm going to weigh in. I think the vision is the vision is the vision. I think the vision should be business-based. I think you should be going after what you actually are trying to do to make money. How you frame the vision is a whole different thing, but I wouldn't build this stuff into the vision. I would have the vision be the vision. then how you actually operationalize the vision, like Paul's talking about, the how, and what practices you do, what heroes you make, what mythology that runs down through the organization. I think that's how you can start to wrap a lot of these practices around. For me, I think the values of the company is what is going to be at the core. I think the vision is a future that is in some way more compelling than where we are today, but I'm pretty darn sure that how it actually gets implemented, like what Paul was saying, and what people really are supported in doing to reach the vision is where a lot of these practices come into play. People talk about failing fast, but if you get punished for failing, you're going to stop doing that. People talk about setting realistic and challenging goals, but if you only get rewarded for goal accomplishment, then you're going to sandbag. People talk about social workplaces, but if managers give the evil eye when you're not working because you're just talking to somebody, that stuff gets stomped out. So I really think that it's finding the practices that fit the values and just allowing things to just emerge. Let the people do whatever they need to do as long as they fit the values and they're all being driven toward the vision. But I wouldn't take it the other way around. I wouldn't say we're doing all of this or we want to be doing all of this, so that goes into our vision. I would suggest the vision is the vision, and then how you operationalize it is where these things come into play.
You know, I would, Dana, I would agree with Steve, because I know we're running out of time. My last comment is I read a lot. I see these studies. One of them, actually a couple of them I've come across recently, and one that a speaker on culture presented was that companies that you and I, if we made a list of them, would agree are recognized as high culture companies, typically outperform other companies in terms of their stock price, in terms of what they deliver to their shareholders. You know, and that's counterintuitive for some older people, but it is factually correct.
And I think that's why, Larry, there are a lot of companies that actually embed being an employer of choice into their vision because they believe it will be a competitive advantage for them in some way.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree.
Let's go around real quick, take 1 minute for a final thought from everybody, just to quick summation of what we've been talking about today and any suggestions for those that are listening to this at all different level sizes of companies.
Well, this is
Larry. Well, for me.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead, Larry. No, go ahead.
Yeah, my I guess my final comment listening to all this is get over it. It's here to stay. Just get on it. Do it. You know, quit complaining. Think for just a moment who created these millennials and their habits. We did. We raised them. Now figure it out.
To me, it's build a compelling picture, a compelling environment that people feel a deep sense of belonging to, and that will create more revenue and success than you can ever imagine.
Yeah, I'll build on that. I think this is a trendy topic. But if you treat it like window dressing, people will see right through it. So, you know, I'm working with an employer with about 500 employees right now doing strategic planning, and they're having me talk to as many of them as I possibly can because they truly care about getting their input. And I think that's what employees are looking for today. They want to be part of something bigger than they are.
Yeah. I've worked for a lot of big companies. I've worked for a lot of small companies. I think if I had to give advice around being an employer of choice, I would say do something really cool and then allow people to self-organize as much as possible underneath. I don't think they will hurt you, and I think they will come up with new and exciting ways to do things that will surprise everyone and push the boundaries of traditional thinking.
Wow. This has been an amazing time. I know I learned a lot. Typically, we would open the lineup, but we're over time here, and I know you guys have a busy schedule, so I don't want to keep you any longer. But first, I want to thank everyone for attending today. You'll all receive the slides and also the audio for today's program. If you want to sign up for our next program, you can sign up today. It's called Pre-Sale Planning, Maximize the Market Value of Your Company. That's going to take place on July 31st. I couldn't think of a more amazing group of thought leaders to have on this program. So I want to thank Larry, Mark, Steve, and Paul, in no particular order there. And if anyone wants to reach out to any of the panelists today, their contact information is available to you. We'll be sending you their contact information. Please email, call them, do whatever technology you like to use, you'll get hold of them. So I want to thank everybody once again for participating and sharing such a cool topic. So have a wonderful day. And again, thank you for being on Open Line.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Dana.
Thanks, Dana.
Yeah.
Talk to you guys soon. Okay, bye-bye. Everyone have a wonderful day.
Bye.
Anybody still on?
Yeah, I'm still on. It was great, man. I enjoyed working with you guys. Wow.
That was
I'm inspired.
Fun. No, I like doing that kind of stuff. That was fun.
It was a lot of fun. We ought to do a road show to go around the country. I'm sure it's going to be fantastic.
Dana did a nice job, too. I thought everybody did. I thought everybody had their own pieces, and I thought it really fit together well.
Yeah,
that was
fun.
Good. Yeah. Well, good luck with your new book, Paul.
Hey, thanks. Hey, I got a 28-year-old millennium exchanging coaching for PR working on it, so we'll see.
Nice. That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Good job, bud. All right, I'm going to drop off. You take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.